Oh, so we're continuing now into our Old Testament journey, and this is about living Christ. And we're going to talk about Joseph today. And I'm trying to get through the whole story of Joseph, which is like quite a few chapters in the Bible at once. And as I was trying to prepare for this, I thought, well, wow, there's a lot in Joseph. How are you going to draw out, you know, God, what do you want to say to the congregation about Joseph? It's kind of a weird thing. And then it was this that kind of came to my mind, sort of because of so different things that have been happening this week. And so it's kind of when things don't go according to plan and things just seem so unfair. So there's been a couple things that happened this week which made me think of this. And as I was reading Joseph, I realized this is very similar to the kind of story that's happening with him. The first is I have some bad news, and I'll start with this piece of bad news, which is we're not going to get the building. Yeah, it turns out we've been outbid due to a lot of, I don't know, they haven't really communicated too much on our part, but they kind of got back to us this week and said, oh, we've decided to go with another offer. So we're not, again, I think half the church committee is still half partially in denial. No, if we throw more money at them, maybe they'll accept it. Maybe that will happen. And I think we're just trying to explore options now. So obviously that's kind of a heartbreaking thing, is because it's one of, they led us on this whole time. And I'm totally like, oh my gosh, we're so going to get together. And then at the last second, they're like, oh, I'm sorry. This guy's got more money. And then it was like, oh, what? Why you do that to me? You know, after all we've done for you, walk by your building. And anyways, so that was one of the things. And it's difficult because one of those things where like, well, we're a church and we don't have lots of money and we can't get into bidding wars with organizations because we can't win. And then there's that question of like, oh, it can feel a bit deflating, and it's kind of like, oh God, you know, how is this, you know, what's going to happen, and is our church ever going to become fire safe? So that was the first kind of thing that happened. The second thing that happened this week, which then made the building seem painful but not that bad, was that, I don't know if you've seen my on Facebook, I have two friends of mine who are in Qatar, and they adopted three black kids from Africa, and they've adopted them over the years. And the most recent one they adopted was a little black girl, and she, because of growing up in extreme poverty, she had eating disorders and sometimes would not eat for a few days, which was, talking to a lot of specialists and going to the doctors, they said, yeah, it's probably normal because of the way they've been growing up. And so he was working in Qatar, and he... The husband and the family, they're all out there, and they were homeschooling the kids, and the parents are Chinese, and the kids are black, and then the little girl died. And she died because she was going through another one of those binging things. It was 4 days not eating, and it was 4 days, and then she died and passed away. And the authorities arrested the couple and accused them of organ harvesting, that they were trying to just take the daughter to harvest her organs, which is silly because they already have two other kids who are older, they're definitely not planned. And a lot of the things they were saying was like, well, we don't understand why Chinese people would adopt a child that's not your own race. We don't understand why you're homeschooling them. And they're homeschooling them because they're Christians, and they didn't want to put them in the local schools. And so they were accused, and they were put into prison and taken away from their kids for a year. And then recently they had a case, and then the children were sent back to the States, but they were kept in prison for another 10 months. And then they had another court hearing this week. And, you know, all their friends and all of us were praying for them. And they get to the court case, and there's no charges laid out onto them, just a sentence. So there's no opportunity to defend themselves or to kind of explain or to talk about the pathologist report and all these things not being accurate and explaining. And they were just sentenced to 3 years in prison and a fine, and then to be deported. And they've already spent all their money on legal fees and trying to appeal to the U.S. government and the embassy to try to get them set. And they have another chance to have another appeal in a couple, 2 weeks. But when that news broke, it was very heartbreaking, because one of those things, well, that's just... like the injustice is just so so wrong. And it's a question like, well, God, you know, why aren't you delivering, you know, your good people? Like, these are, I went to church with these guys growing up. Then they're being printed. There's a really good, if you go to my Facebook and my profile, I linked to one of the articles. New York Times has a really good write-up on it about their time in prison and the difficulties that's been for them and the prospect of facing another 3 years is... because at the moment they're like Skyping their kids at home and trying to still homeschool them, but you can imagine another 3 years in prison and then their kids will be like 11 and they're already adopted, so it's very difficult. And so that was one of the things that kind of happened this week, which was kind of also very shocking. And on one hand, it puts my life here into perspective, also puts the building into perspective. Not that we don't wish we didn't have the building. But suddenly it opens my eyes to, like, actually, well, there's some other really big stuff going on. Then the third thing that happened this week, which was also kind of a bombshell, was I have a friend who I also grew up in church with, a good friend of mine. Well, I mean, we're not super good friends because I moved here. But she was diagnosed with cancer about 10 months ago with a large tumor, aggressive. And she has a son, a little bit in between Alex and Oscar's age. So she went through this trial. She had a blog and she was putting up some things. And then suddenly it just got really bad and she passed away this week. Very, very shocking. You know, you only find out about these things via Facebook nowadays because I'm not in touch with them regularly. So on Facebook, I found out about this. And it's one of those things where, like, you know, God... Why does this stuff kind of happen? You know, this now there's a kid with, you know, his mom's passed away, and she's like 30, she's like in her 30s, right? And I was like, wow, that could be me. It's very sudden. And again, the question is like, okay, well, you know, why God? And I think the first part of us is always to try to ask why. But when you talk to people about this and when they're going through things, they realize actually the question of asking why isn't the main thing they ask anymore. They're just trying to get through each day, trying to get through what to do next. Because sometimes the answers to why aren't going to be clear in this lifetime. And this is something when I started to look at the story of Joseph, I realized there's something happening over and over again in the entire story of Joseph, and it's the sense of the fact that these things are just unfair. The things that are happening are unfair on so many different levels. If you don't have a Bible, I encourage you to get one, because we're not going to read all, like, it's basically from chapter 37 to chapter 50. I could just read it and not give a sermon, and then we're done. But we're not going to do that. I'm going to be just putting up some verses up. So if you need a Bible, raise your hand, and some of these nice people will bring them by. And we'll be starting with Genesis 37. Oh, no, I spilled some water. Right, everyone get a Bible. I was hoping for one. Any more? Okay, that's fine. Let's pray again, and then we'll jump into this. Father, we know that this world is full of trouble and full of difficulty, and there are things that happen that we don't understand and that we can become frustrated, disappointed about. But Lord, we need to look to you, and it's you that we trust and depend on. Just as we come to your word today, Lord, I pray that your spirit opens our eyes and opens our hearts to understanding you, that through this, Lord, our faith might grow, that our adoration of you might grow. So we thank you. In your name we pray. Amen. So starting from Genesis chapter 37, Now, I think last we heard in the Old Testament, we were picking up from Jacob. Jacob ends up having kids. So I think the most significant thing about Jacob is he has two wives, Leah and Rachel. And Rachel is barren, the one that he loves more, apparently, can't have kids. So what happens out is there becomes a birthing war that happens between Jacob and his two wives and their servants. So what keeps happening over and over again is he sleeps with Leah. They have a baby. They have another baby. Then Rachel says, "That's not fair. Sleep with my my servant. You can have a baby from the servant. The servant has a baby." Then Leah says, "Fine, sleep with my servant," and the servant has a baby. And then God says, then finally Rachel has a baby, and Rachel's like, "I got a baby now." And then they're like, and then Leah's like, something happens, and then Rachel says, "Fine, you can have Jacob for tonight." And then they sleep together, and they have another baby. And then so it's like, if you think about this, this family must be really messed up. You have kids from one wife number one, wife number two, maidservant number one, maidservant number two, and there's all these kids coming out of this. Now, if you think you've got sibling rivalry problems, can you imagine there's like 12 kids, all different ages, all different parents kind of thing, and you've got these two moms who hate each other. This is messed up. And God is working through this situation. It's funny because this is one of the things where God, you could say, "God, these are really evil people. Can't you just leave it and leave them and find some holier people?" And God is like, "No, you know, my promise is made to this people, and I will see them through it. And I'm going to bring some sort of redemption from this process." So here we have Jacob, and this is about Jacob and the son Joseph, right? So Joseph's the youngest, but there's Benjamin, there's the younger one. So Jacob loved Joseph more than any of his other children because Joseph had been born to him in his old age. In other words, Joseph's really old, and now he's like, it's pretty much like a grandfather. He gets to have his own grandkid that's his son. So he's like, "Oh, I love this one the best." So one day, Jacob made a special gift made for Joseph, a beautiful robe. For his brothers hated Joseph because their father loved him more than the rest of them. They couldn't say a kind word to him. And the first kind of thing that we see is there is this tension that's between the family. But if you look a bit closer, there's a sense of injustice, actually, on a personal level, a personal relational level. All the other brothers are like, what, we're older, we work hard, and Joseph, he gets everything. You know, he gets the love, he gets a special coat, he gets to stay inside. He's the spoiled brat of this family. And yet he gets this. He's like the youngest child, and like he gets his way all the time. Now you have to understand when the Bible writes this, it sounds oh, they couldn't say a kind word to him. But if you think deeper, kind of the emotions here is these guys hate their brother. You know, they're sick of seeing him. You know, he always gets his way. And so when you break it down, there's a fight breaking out, and they're always like, "No, just let Joseph have it. Just let Joseph do his thing, what he wants. Listen to Joseph." And you can sense there's just a greater animosity. What's funny is, as the story goes on, Joseph starts having these dreams, right? And he comes out and he says these dreams, and the first one is like, these sheaves of wheat are bowing down to him, and they're like, "What? So you're going to say, you know, Joseph, who do you think you are? You think we're all going to bow to you one day?" In other words, Joseph is sounding more and more arrogant or cocky or proud because he has special position. He knows his dad loves him best. And then he goes on, he has another dream where the sun and the moon bow to him, and then his parents have to actually kind of scold him and say, "What are you saying, that we're going to bow to you too?" And Joseph's like, "Yeah." And there's a sense of like, oh, you know, this guy is supremely confident, bordering on arrogant. And so what we see here is there's this familial injustice and frustration going on. And you also probably guess that a lot of this is projected from all the family problems they have is brought down to this battle between Joseph and his brothers. Because what happens here is we see actually they end up getting rid of Joseph. Picking up from verse 18, when Joseph's brothers saw him coming, so Joseph's like, his dad's like, "Okay, go bring this food to your brothers." And he's like, "Okay." And he goes out and he can't find his brothers, and he asks this guy. And the guy says, oh, they went over there. And so he goes out. When Joseph's brothers saw him coming, they recognized him in the distance. As he approached, they made plans to kill him. Here comes the dreamer, they said. Come on, let's kill him and throw him into one of the cisterns. We can tell our father a wild animal has eaten him. Then we'll see what becomes of his dreams. So, like, this is called patricide. And if we remember in Genesis, this happened as well, where Cain killed Abel. This sort of brother animosity, this sort of jealousy, this sort of injustice. So they're actually planning to kill him. And then Reuben heard of their scheme. He came to Joseph's rescue. Let's not kill him, he said. Why should we shed any blood? Let's just throw him into this empty cistern here in the wilderness, and he'll die without laying a hand on him. But Reuben was secretly planning to rescue Joseph and return him to his father. Now, first thing we see from this is that there's kind of two responses to injustice, or when things aren't going right or what you want. The first is to take vengeance into your own hands. In other words, to say, I have the power to decide, and I am going to administer the justice. So they want to bring punishment to him. They want to vindicate themselves. In other words, they're like, well, we might not get the esteem that we want from the father, from Jacob, but we'll punish this kid, Joseph, our brother, instead, so that he can't lord over us anymore. It's kind of like, I think Steve Hancock and I were talking, well, I didn't tell you, you told me your story, but I do the same thing. If someone is driving badly and like they're trying to use the wrong lane in a roundabout or something like that, I will administer justice by, like, you know, either making sure they can't exit if they want to try to scoop around, or just drive slow. I saw this recent video, really bad. So this car was this huge truck was tailing this girl for miles. And she was like within the speed limit and everything like that. And I guess I don't know what she was doing, because it looked like she was filming herself while driving, which I was like, okay, this is already dangerous enough. So what happens is this car, and she's just driving really slowly. And then this car finally gets a chance to overtake her. And he pulls up next to her and he's like swearing at her and then like being really upset, I know, and being not very nice. And then he suddenly he zooms off in front of her, loses control of his car, swerves and crashes into like a light post onto the side. And then as she drives by, she like yells at him, karma! And like, that's what you get! And it's like, whoa. And on one hand, you're kind of like, yeah, that is kind of what you get. But it's that sense of like, yes, the guy was fine. He was driving like a huge Ford F-150. I don't know if he has a seatbelt on though, so that's a good point. Anyway, she obviously didn't, well, she kind of stopped the car, came out to like look and gloat over her triumph. And it's a sense of like, well, we want justice on our own terms, and we want vindication on our own terms, and we want to make it right by our own power. And that's actually a very natural human response. And what we see here is something different is Reuben doesn't want to go that way. He says, okay, well, look, I'm going to go back and rescue him later. In other words, the difference there is that he's not holding on to this seed of bitterness, or he's not even holding on to the sense that somehow he deserves or is entitled to this kind of justice. There's something different about his character or his perspective that allows him to still look into the situation with compassion. Whereas all the brothers are still looking into this with bitterness, with their anger, with the sense of, we have been wronged and we need to, or we deserve to have it made right. And we will do that by our own power. What happens in this story is, in the end, they don't kill him because some people come by and they say, like, hey, we want to buy that kid. They kind of say, you know, we'll sell this boy to you, slave. And they're like, yeah, we made money off of this as well. It's better than killing him. And then they smeared blood on the robe and they took it back to their dad. And I always wonder, like, when they brought that robe back to their dad and then their dad, like, breaks down, I wonder if at that moment they're like, oh, I kind of feel kind of bad now. This seemed like a good idea at the time. And if you know what it really makes me think of? It really makes me think of Jesus. You're in Judas sells Jesus off for some money, and he's got this money, and then he finds out later that when Jesus is crucified, and he's like, oh my gosh, this guy is this innocent man, and he throws the money down. I wonder if these brothers, when they go back and they tell their dad, and they say, your son's been killed, and his dad just like starts wailing, if they're like, what have we done? I can imagine some of the brothers like, I don't want this blood money, and just throw it to the side. It's funny because they want this kind of vindication, and they feel like they can get this justice, but when they actually get to that point, you know, felt good for a moment to sell their brother, but when the reality hits, they're like, actually, this is not what I wanted. So what happens? Joseph ends up being sold. He gets taken to Egypt, which is coincidence, I suppose, you might say, or godly chosen, which we'll find out later. And he ends up working in the palace, and he just works hard. Okay, now this is a big deal. This is a big deal here because Joseph was just taken by his brother, dumped in the cistern. He was probably going to get killed. Then he gets sold into slavery. At this point, if anyone has the right to be bitter, it's Joseph. He could be really ticked off at his brothers and be really frustrated, and he has no choice. It's funny because you later hear that actually he's in the cistern, and there he actually has a conversation with his brothers, which is like, save me, get me out of here, don't leave me here to die. And his brothers just turn a blind ear to this, right? So what happens is he gets there, but Joseph doesn't. He just works. Okay, maybe he's working to be like, one day I'm going to work, and then when I... It's like Liam Neeson, right? He's just working hard so that one day he can go back and exert his revenge on his brothers. But you don't really get that because he doesn't know what's going to happen to him. So he's just working. And eventually he moves up inside the household so that he becomes like the master of the house, except not like the Thunder Years. And so he's like working. And then the Potiphar's wife is like, dude, that is some nice eye candy there. And she's like, wow, this Hebrew guy, he looks really hot. So she tries to seduce him. And so let's read this. Genesis, picking up from Genesis 38:9. When she saw that, I'm trying to make this as fast as possible. She tries to seduce him. He's like, no, you are the wife of my master. And then he runs away and she grabs his cloak and he's like running away. And then she holds the cloak. And then she saw that she was holding his cloak and he had fled. She called out to her servants and soon all the men came running. Look, she said, my husband has brought this Hebrew slave here to make fools of us. He came into my room to rape me, but I screamed. When he heard me scream, he ran outside and got away. But he left his cloak behind with me. She kept the cloak with her until her husband came home. Then she told him her story. That Hebrew slave you've brought into our house tried to come in and fool around with me, she said. But when I screamed, he ran outside, leaving his cloak with me. Potiphar was furious when he heard his wife's story about how Joseph had treated her. So he took Joseph and threw him into prison where the king's prisoners were held. And there he remained. Like, we're looking at Joseph's life, and now he's another victim of injustice. Okay, you're a boy. You get thrown into a well. You get sold into slavery. As you grow up in a foreign land with foreign people, you work hard, and suddenly you earn this thing. And he's probably thinking to himself, like, even though things are bad, I've made the best of a situation, and here I am today. You know, this is pretty good. I'm the master of this household. Then it all comes crumbling down. One false allegation, one angry Potiphar, and he gets thrown into prison again. Like, so one time of injustice, trying to be killed by your brother, that's pretty bad. Happening a second time, that just really sucks. And how does he deal with this? I mean, like, how do you pick yourself up to go through this all over again after you've been through this hard time? I mean, this is worse than, like, I dated someone for 3 years and then we broke up and now I've got to pick myself all up to try to date someone else again. This is much worse. This is like my whole life was built up and here I am in prison again. We see here, actually, in verse 21, but the Lord was with Joseph in the prison and showed him his faithful love. And the Lord made Joseph a favorite with the prison warden. And before long, the warden put Joseph in charge of all other prisoners and everything that happened in the prison. The warden had no more worries because Joseph took care of everything. The Lord was with him and caused everything he did to succeed. Now, when we read this, we just think, oh, so God was with him and it made it all fine. And then our frustration is like, well, how do we sense God with us? If you just look at this for a little bit, and you understand Joseph's probably emotional and physical and mental state, if there's someone that he's probably really upset at, it's also God. God, how could you let this happen to me? God, I was following your commandments and I was doing the right thing. This woman wanted to sleep with me, but I said no. And this is how I get repaid? See, God is still continually showering his love upon Joseph. Okay, that hasn't changed. And Joseph has an opportunity here. Does he respond in a bitter and angry way? Or does he trust God still? That's the challenge that we face all the time, isn't it? When something bad happens to us, when we step into sin, when something goes wrong, when we're struggling with the issues that we've had in our life, we're faced with that moment where we say, well, can we trust you, God? This is so unfair that I have to deal with this. But Joseph here gives us this example where he's like, you know what? I will trust you, God. And in God's love and favor, it means that Joseph moves up in the prison world, which doesn't sound like a whole lot. But he does have some authority and responsibility even in this place. You see two things happening here. One is Joseph's character being continually shaped and refined. Instead of becoming more bitter and more angry and more vindictive, he's becoming more responsible, more patient, more understanding, more like God. So let's look on. Genesis chapter 40. What happens here is, so he's in prison, and then the cupbearer and the baker get thrown in prison. And they're like, hey, we had these dreams, and what's going to happen to us? And then Joseph's like, okay, I can interpret these dreams, or God will give me the strength to interpret the dreams. Let me tell you what happens. So this is what happens. This is what the dream means, Joseph said. The three branches represent 3 days. Within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift you up and restore you to your position as chief cupbearer. And please remember me and do me a favor when things go well for you. Mention me to Pharaoh so he might let me out of this place. For I was kidnapped from my homeland, the land of the Hebrews, and now I'm here in prison, but I did nothing to deserve it. Pharaoh's chief cupbearer, however, forgot all about Joseph, never giving him another thought. So the second dream was pretty bad, like, oh, you're going to get your head chopped off. So Joseph answers this guy's dreams, and he says, remember me and go and tell the Pharaoh that I'm innocent. And then the guy goes back up and completely forgets about Joseph. Okay, if you're in prison and you talk to this guy and you know he's going to live and you know you're innocent and you know he's going to talk to the king, and you say this and you tell him, when he goes back up, every day you're thinking to yourself, am I going to get set free today? Did the cupbearer tell the king today that I'm going to be set free? You know, did the cupbearer tell the king today? Every day your hope is that you're going to be let out of prison today. Today's the day that the cupbearer remembers you and you're going to be let out of prison. You know, a week goes by, maybe 2 weeks, maybe a month goes by, maybe 2 months go by, maybe a year goes by, and you still have this hope. You know, but 2-3 years later, you're like, okay, dude, totally forgot about me. And I tell you, one of the things you'll feel then is the sense of injustice as well. Because when you have that moment of hope, you're like, oh, God, you hear me. You're going to get me out of this. You know, God, I can trust in you. And then when it doesn't happen and it all falls out, you think to yourself, God, where are you again? Can I still trust you? Well, in this case, Joseph deals with this injustice the same way he always has, which is, you know, I'm just going to trust God. And when he says he's going to trust God, he doesn't imagine that he's going to somehow eventually get out of prison. He might hope it, But he just trusts that God is still God, that God is still sovereign. So we go on, and the cupbearer finally remembers Joseph because the king has a dream. And I'll tell you why the cupbearer suddenly remembers. Because the cupbearer is like, oh, this will make me look good in front of the Pharaoh because I can help him solve his problem. So he gets Joseph out. Joseph comes out. And he says to Joseph, I had these dreams. Can you interpret them? And this is Joseph's response. And this is how we know that he is not vindictive or he's not bitter at God. Because this is his chance, right? He can come out and sound all great and awesome and sound really cocky and be like the young Joseph. But he says, it is beyond my power to do this, Joseph replied. But God can tell you what it means and set you at ease. You know what's amazing about this line is that this is not just true for the Pharaoh, but it's true for Joseph as well. See, God, he knows the meaning for these things, and his mind is at ease. When you're imprisoned for injustice, if you are suffering your life and you want to understand the meaning of this life and you're wrestling with it, Joseph has asked God many, many times, what does it mean? In this, somehow, God has made it clear that the meaning of life isn't about your position or about what job you're in, but your meaning in life is God. And his mind and his life is at ease because he can trust God. Now, what happens is Pharaoh has this dream, and then basically Joseph says, look, it's going to be 7 years of great harvest and 7 years of bad harvest. And it's going to be a horrible famine sweep across the land. And God's telling you this, you can prepare. And Pharaoh says, hey, guy who just came out of prison because I was angry with you, I'm going to put you in charge of everything now. You're going to be in charge of this entire operation. How does this happen? Okay, generally, if you are a convict, it is very difficult to get a job when you get out. And yet, somehow, in this situation, Joseph gets put into the highest position in the kingdom. How does this happen? Well, you know what? Joseph, when he comes out, he doesn't even think this is a job interview. It's not like he's prepared. It's not like he's wearing his best suit. But there's something about his character, this certainty, this confidence in God, this hope of God. He's not there pleading or making a fool of himself. He's just telling it like it is. And in this one moment, the Pharaoh looks at him and says, you know what? You're not insecure. You're not bitter. You are trustworthy. You are faithful. You are dependable. I can look at you and I can trust this. In other words, this whole time, this whole life, all these experiences that Joseph's been going has been sort of shaping his character for this moment. But it could have gone completely the other way, couldn't it? His brothers throw him into the pit. He gets sold into slavery. He becomes so bitter and so angry. He's always got temper. He's always got an attitude. So then he doesn't move up in the ranking. He doesn't make it into the master's house. Or let's say he gets that far. Then his Potiphar's wife tries to sleep with him. If he's a bitter, vengeful, angry man, he probably sleeps with her and just like, yeah, whatever, I have no value for human life. But he doesn't. Let's say he somehow resists and gets thrown in prison and he lets this bitterness overtake him. He doesn't move forward. His character never shapes. And yet, because he kept trusting God, finds his meaning in God, that his mind and his heart are at ease, he gets brought to this place, right? And then comes the most emotional part of this story. And it's weird because maybe it's just been a really emotional week for me, but as I read through this last few chapters from 42 to the end of Joseph's story, and you read about Joseph and his brothers, like my heart was like, wow, this makes me want to cry because there's so much passion here. What happens is the famine strikes across the whole of the land, and basically all the civilized world is undergoing famine. Egypt's the only place with food. So they all go to Egypt, and people are going there to buy food from them. And so Joseph's brothers are like, okay, we got to go food. They get out there. Joseph sees them and is like, oh my gosh, those are my brothers. If he was vindictive, if there's any time for payback, this is it. This is his Liam Neeson moment, and he's going to break everyone's legs. Or he could be worse, and you think maybe he's just plotting some sort of revenge, but he doesn't. And we see some of the most amazing things about Joseph's heart through this. Genesis 4:2. They get thrown in prison, and they're like, "Oh my gosh, what's happening?" And then, speaking among themselves, they said, "Clearly, we are being punished because of what we did to Joseph long ago. We saw his anguish when we pleaded for his life, but we didn't listen. That's why we're in trouble." In other words, they think this is karma. Come back to get them. Still the same thing. Like Joseph's like, "Look, you can go back, but I'm keeping this son here. I'm keeping your brother here, and you have to bring the youngest brother back with you next time. Otherwise, you know, you'll never see this guy again." And Reuben's like, "Didn't I tell you not to sin against that boy?" Reuben asked, but you wouldn't listen. And now we had an answer for his blood. It's funny because they're like Chinese people. They're all talking in Chinese. And then like it's funny because Joseph understands, right? So it's like the non-Chinese guy who's sitting there like, "Yeah, you think I don't understand what you're saying, but you guys look like fools." What's amazing, because right in verse 23, of course they didn't know that Joseph understood them, for he had been pretending like he couldn't understand, speaking through interpreter. And now he turned away from them and began to weep. You know, he's not vindictive. He's not bitter. You know, God has made this whole injustice meaningful to him. And he's crying because actually he wants to love his brothers, but he wants to know that they're not the same guys they used to be. So he's like crying. So this is like, you have to imagine, this is like a guy who's like almost like Pharaoh. And he's like weeping. And then he's like, I'm not crying, it's cool. And he turns back and says, "Oh." And then he arrests. And he like binds up Simeon like in front of them. "Ha ha, I've got him now." Then later he comes out again, and his brothers come back, and they end up bringing Benjamin, the youngest one, there with him. And when Joseph sees this, it's like flashbacks. It's like, oh my gosh, it's like looking at a young himself. He's like, oh my gosh, and they had to bring him here. And he's probably thinking about his father, how much his father is hurting through this. Because actually Joseph misses them. He hasn't seen them in, you know, 20-odd years now. So in Genesis 43, we see the same sort of thing. Joseph hurried from the room. His old brothers come in, and he has a meal for them, and you see them. He has a run out of the room because he was overcome with emotion for his brother. He went into his private room where he broke down and wept. This is like he sees his youngest brother, and then he just suddenly leaves the room and goes and has a cry. Like all these years of emotion and, you know, even the sense of injustice all kind of pouring out, and this love that he has for them is seen there. Then he comes back out, keeping himself under control. Then he ordered, "Bring out the food." It's so funny. And then he does this little trick, this one last trick to see what happens. And so he says, "Okay, you guys can all go back and, you know, head on back." And he hides his silver cup in the youngest son, Benjamin's, bag. And as they all head back, he tells his servant, "Go and find them, search their bags, and bring back the one who has the silver cup." And he goes back, and then they find the guy in the silver cup, and he says, "Oh, it's Benjamin. No, we're going to arrest him and take him back." And all the brothers are like, "No, this we're not letting you do this, okay? Okay, we feel bad enough as it is for our last brother. You're not taking him back." But it's not just that. It's actually because they love their father, and they don't want to see their father's heart broken. So they all go back, and then they say, look, take me instead. Do whatever you want with me. I give my life in exchange for my brother's." And at that point, Joseph sees, you know, these guys are serious. And in Genesis 45:1, Joseph could stand it no longer. There were many people in the room, and he said to all his attendants, "Out, all of you." So he sends all the people out. So he was alone with his brothers when he told them who he was. Then he broke down and wept. And he wept so loudly the Egyptians could hear him, and word of it quickly carried to Pharaoh's palace. Can you imagine this? This guy is like bawling his eyes out. This is the opposite of what his brothers probably imagined, right? If they were the ones in power, would they love the same way? You see actually that this guy who suffered so much injustice, who felt like so many things went wrong in his life, who could have said, I'm cursed, you know, God has abandoned me, and yet through the whole process knew where God was, knew God's enduring love. Let God teach him and trust and be able to him for him to trust God. It's such a powerful thing. He actually then says, please come closer, he said to them. So they came closer and he said again. You can probably tell, they're probably all still really shocked. One of the reasons they're shocked is because Joseph probably doesn't look like Joseph, because Egyptians had very different kind of laws in terms of how they're supposed to look and things like that. So they're like freaking out. But it's probably even crazier because Joseph's now speaking to them in like Hebrew. They're like, oh my, what's going on here? Is it a ghost? He tells them to come closer, and he says, I am Joseph, your brother whom you sold into slavery in Egypt, but don't be upset and don't be angry with yourselves for selling me to this place. It was God who sent me here ahead of you to preserve your lives. It's amazing because Joseph's like, you know, I didn't know it was going to turn out like this. I had no idea that my life could have meaning so many years out from here. You know, I thought I was abandoned to die in a well, abandoned to die in a prison. But God has shown himself to be even more trustworthy. And you get the feeling suddenly like one of the reasons Joseph was crying and so emotional was that he's looking at his life now. He's looking at the position he's in. And he's seeing his brothers coming here for food. And he realizes, God, your love is so great that you would bring me to this place now at this time so that my brothers and my father could have food so many years in the future. You suddenly realize, wow, how small we are compared to God's amazing grace in his hand. And even though people in this world and sinful nature means that we're so capable of injustice, God himself is still so redeeming and so loving. He says in verse 6, this famine that has ravaged the land for 2 years will last for 5 more years, and then there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. God has sent me ahead of you to keep you and your families alive and to preserve many survivors. So it was God who sent me here, not you. And he is the one who made me an advisor to Pharaoh, the manager of his entire palace, and the governor of all Egypt. There's not an ounce of pride there, is there? It all goes back to God. And this is not just like lip service after scoring a goal. God, this is God. You are amazing. You are the amazing orchestrator of things. And Joseph, who could have been bitter and vindictive every single way, who could have tried to take vengeance into his old hands like his brother, discovers the joy of releasing that to God. He goes on, then Joseph added, look, you can see for yourselves, and so can my brother Benjamin, that I really am Joseph. Go tell my father of my honor and position here in Egypt. Describe for him everything you have seen, and then bring my father here quickly. Weeping with joy, he embraced Benjamin, and Benjamin did the same. Then Joseph kissed each of his brothers and wept over them, and after that they began talking freely with him. What a change. What an amazing change. And we're talking about brothers from different mothers in a messed up family, with a brother here who they tried to kill, and a younger brother who they feel really guilty for bringing out here, and suddenly there's this amazing moment of reconciliation and of joy and of eating and of fellowship and this eagerness to bring the father back so that he can see, you know, what God has done. Now, there's one more thing that happens, actually. All right, so let me tell you this cool thing. This is how all the people end up in Egypt, by the way. And this is really important because God needs to bring all the people to Egypt. Because Egypt has really strict kind of laws in terms of don't sleep with the foreigners, don't mix with them. So that means that actually God can build his nation in Egypt safely without interspersing. He can begin teaching them what holiness means because of that. And so this is how he gets them to Egypt. Because the father and all their tribes and all the things get settled in Egypt. Joseph is there. Then what happens is Jacob eventually dies. And Jacob says, don't bury me here, bury me back in Canaan. And then after Jacob dies, all the brothers are like, Okay, so Jacob's dead now. Our dad's dead. Joseph's going to get his revenge now. He's just been waiting all these years. He's going to come and get us now. And in Genesis 50, Joseph replied, "Don't be afraid of me. Am I God that I can punish you? You intend to harm me, but God intended all for good. He brought me to this position so I could save the lives of many people. No, don't be afraid. I will continue to take care of you and your children." So he reassured them by speaking kindly to them. See, the key sometimes to dealing with injustice is to understand that God is still in control. That, yeah, this is a broken world. That people make broken decisions on a personal level, on a relational level. But God is the one who judges. Vengeance is his, vindication is his. And when we trust in him, when we find our hope in him, we'll discover that meaning and that purpose in life. Just some final thoughts before we come into worship. You might feel like a victim of injustice. Personally, the feeling like, why was I born this way? Why do I have these things in my life? Why do I have these issues? Why did I have to be in this family that made me turn out this way? You might be a victim of injustice in your workplace, like you keep getting looked over for promotion or you keep getting thrown all the bad work. Relationally, you might have been left out by your parents or by your boyfriend or girlfriend or by your friends or by your peers. And even in other ways, like my friends who are unjustly incarcerated in Qatar. But what we understand is actually you have to trust God. See, vindication is found in him. Forgiveness is found in him. Perspective in life is found in him. And the power to proceed is found in him. You won't be able to move forward in your marriages, in your friendships, in your relationships, in your personal struggles, in your own insecurities, until you come to Jesus and say, "Jesus, I look to you and I trust in you." Let's pray. Lord God, I know that in this room, you know, we struggle with how we feel like we've been wronged in different ways. And some of it might be small compared to others. And we might not feel like it's a big deal, but some of these things are big deals to us. Lord, let us not have the seed of bitterness or of vengeance take root in our heart, but let us know that vindication found in you, to forgive, to let our hearts be healed so that we can forgive, not just out of, you know, our own decision, but out of your love. The same way that Joseph could just pour out that forgiveness and love to his brothers. God, show us your eternal perspective and to know the joy of what it means to actually walk and start moving forward in life with you. Whether we are struggling with our workplace or unemployment, whether it's with our friends and family or our husbands or our wives, or even with our health and the ailments that we suffer, let us find our hope and our trust in you. Because you never fail. In your name we pray.